All right, everyone, it's the Grim Lord here, and a long time coming, we've got more maggot baits. I don't know if I'll get finished. I'm trying to get finished with this one so we can get on to other ones because the story's really good. And of course, we'll do the regular ending and the true ending. You have to beat the game once, and then you can get the true ending. But the first ending is not very good, and the second ending is very good. So we'll, you know, work that out. All world problems can be surely solved with kindness. That was the topic of the essay she wrote for a modern language assignment last week. She wrote it herself and turned it in. The teacher gave her high marks and praised it as exemplary, but her classmates teased her a lot for it. They said the local headache medicine was only half made with kindness. It just went to show how childish and dubious the content was. If you greeted someone with a smile, they would do the same, and if everyone smiled like that, the world would forever be peaceful and kind. She unashamedly wrote a whole paper on things like that. She had to admit she was a bit full of herself there. It was full of the innocently bright and idealistic ideas even J-pop barely sung about these days. She knew the teachers would love if she wrote things like that, but she didn't have ulterior motives like that when she composed it. After all, she truly lived her life by those beliefs. Obviously, God longed for a world where people could smile too. She might not have known much about religion, but most churches probably taught something similar. She knew there were plenty of hardships and tragic events in the world. She had friends who never made up after a fight. Cruel crimes were covered daily on the news, and she knew there was always a war going on overseas. But even knowing all that, she believed something could be done someday. She believed a world where all people cherished each other was possible. Of course, part of that was because she was an innocent student in peaceful Japan, but she realized that. She wasn't confident in her intelligence, but she still had that much self-awareness. For example, even if the recession had lasted several decades and their country's suicide rates were the highest in the world, she could still go to school every day, play her favorite smartphone games, and eat delicious food. She didn't have to sell her body to live or wield a gun on the battlefield. She was born in a miraculously peaceful country, but she felt undirected guilt when she learned about child soldiers younger than her in Africa or young prostitutes in South America and Southeast Asia forced to take customers before their first menstruation. At the same time, she recently began to believe that since she was born in such a blessed environment, she should believe in those ideals others would laugh at. It's probably very unlikely anyone forced to endure such daily oppression and violence would live life with such beliefs. Their circumstances warranted the deepest sympathies. But what if someone as happy as herself denies those ideals as well? Is it really alright for her to walk around like a know-it-all and declare this world is devoid of love and kindness just because there are so many pitiful people out there? All the pretty beautiful things in this world would truly be gone if she did, wouldn't they? For one thing, her parents and other adults taught her to live that way as a child. It was one of the first things she learned, so of course it was important. But before one knows, they believe such ideals are impossible lies. Someone may do something terrible to them, or they may give in and do something cheap or dirty, switching their views to preserve themselves. Telling themselves this world is only full of malice, that it's only natural for people to do wrong, and to protect themselves from such things, they shouldn't trust others either. But she was sure she was wrong. It wasn't this world that turned those ideals into lies, it was always people themselves. So she vowed that she would at least hold faith. No matter how often she may lose to cheating and dirty tricks, and no matter what cruel fates may befall her, that was her one duty to uphold as someone born in this happy country. Because she was born without a care and lived without want, she had to believe in people's kindness and goodwill. Although she always felt that way, hardly any of her classmates would go along with it. In fact, they said numerous things like, blank 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 is acting like an impossibly good girl, or she's after men. But she knew there were plenty of people that understood, too. For example, when she was in elementary school, she picked up a 10-yen coin off the street and delivered it to the police box. It was such a small amount of money that whomever dropped it would hardly ever notice. But when she turned it in, the police officer gave her lots of praise. That's how she learned. No matter how small the action, there was always a reward. Doing what you believe is right is never a waste. The police officer had given her 10-yen wrapped in paper as a reward of gratitude. Thinking back now, it was probably the 10-yen coin she picked up, but at the time, she was simply overjoyed. If there ever comes a time in her future when she stops believing in the world's kindness, she would probably remember that police officer's 10-yen coin. Those thoughts crossed her mind as she looked up at the vast, deep blue of the autumn sky stretching far and wide, a sky she would likely watch for many decades to come. Kanto's Pandemonium. While its land rested within Japanese territory, it was a lawless, extraterritorial city. The concrete and glass grave markers that have been abandoned by the country still housed a large number of humans just as before, despite it all. The sleepless electric lights constantly continue to burn in the night sky. Nearly 10 years have passed since the government abandoned it, but it still offered the same prosperity without inconvenience as it did in old times. The reason for that was the stability of its lifelines, the infrastructure necessary for life, electric, sewage, city, gas, and communication networks, continue to be provided on the same lines leading to former Kajo City. That was the evil fruit of the witch hunter's exchange with certain bureaucrats and financiers. It went further than that, too. There were rumors of foreign influence from top powers of state as well. This nation has long been vulnerable to foreign pressure, which shaped its fate over time. The ground beneath old Kajo City contained utility tunnels that supported multiple lifelines, such as power lines and optical fibers. The sturdy tunnels were constructed by boring a hole 20-some meters beneath the city using shield tunneling. The emergency lamps stood out in parts of the darkness, filling those vast man-made tubes. The unique chill and quiet of the underground filled those tubes for the great distances. They were like modern catacombs erected from concrete and metal. Footsteps echoed within those sealed underground tunnels. Two pairs, one man, another, a woman. Sunaga's tall frame walked at the fore. Beside him, falling like a shadow, was the fleeting silhouette of the witch, Carol. Both were silent, mentally and physically merging with the heavy underground quiet. Something kept that silence from being uncomfortable, though. Sunaga's gaze was like a hunting dog's, piercing and glaring off into the far distance, down the endlessly stretching pitch-black tunnel. Nothing else was in there, as if saying there was nothing worth looking back on in this world. It was as if that darkness was symbolizing the individual known as Sunaga. Perhaps this man was staring at the unlit darkness spreading within his own cranium. However, more than just darkness was reflected in Carol's pomegranate eyes as she followed behind Sunaga. His back was constantly in her vision. The emergency lights were spaced apologetically apart in the dim, inky darkness. His broad shoulders shook as he walked beneath them, along with his silent, stony, and strong back. He would never vanish from the world Carol saw. Sunaga had chosen to infiltrate Slumville using these underground utility tunnels. He received a map of Kojo City utility tunnels from Ego, having pounded it into his head already. Beneath Slumville, the former Northeast Grand Hills, there was a private service elevator. From there, he could aim for the blocks on the top floors while avoiding the groups of armed residents that crowded its interior. He also used Allison as a disposable decoy for the plan. After making sure she rushed in, they took action. Presently, none should be paying attention below. The remains had been abandoned for nearly 10 years as it was. Wait. However, the moment they came to the crossroads where the tunnel opened up to the left and right, Sunaga ordered Carol to stop, sensing something wrong in the air. He hadn't seen or heard anything, but his instincts warned him of powerful danger. Perhaps it was the layout of the space, if an ambush was laid out in the side tunnels they had just passed. The moment Sunaga turned, shadows rose from both side tunnels, each silhouette carrying automatic rifles in their hands. He barely managed to drop in the nick of time. They opened fire in their burst, sending tracer bullets shooting over his head. At the same time, a fierce rush of fire assailed them from the direction they were heading. Sparks and spent cartridges scattered across the tunnel, lighting it up. They were caught in a pincer attack. Carol leapt out, clad in a glowing light, shielding Sunaga from their front. Over 20 5.56mm high-speed bullets were returned to dust in an instant by her repulsion field's intervention. Carol, silence the ones to our fore. I'll do something about the enemies behind us. Using Carol and her repulsion field as cover, Sunaga launched rapid shots to cover to the rear with his Frenchie SPAS. The buckshot shaved away the tunnel walls as fragments soared through the air. Two enemies ducked their heads back into the side tunnels. Sunaga used that opening to pull an aluminum can from his pocket and toss it 5 meters down the cross tunnels. It hit the wall with a hard clang, clattering to the ground. A man lurking in the sides panicked and leapt out. Sunaga pulled the trigger on his Frenchie, slamming 12-gauge buckshot into the silhouette. The man took a direct hit and went flying backwards. All he'd thrown was an ordinary drink can, but between the darkness and their conditioned reflexes, it had been mistaken for a... Hold on. It had been mistaken for a hand grenade. The other man who ducked further down his passage at the lure noticed it a few seconds later. But Sunaga used the cessation of fire to close the distance and already had the other man in his sights. He aimed his Frenchie muzzle like a spear, pulling the trigger on its rapid fire. The shells of buckshot loaded into the inside the semi-automatic exited the muzzle in rapid succession. The man was slammed into the wall by the heavy blow of nearly 20 buckshot pellets, but he still tried to raise the muzzle of his rifle as he groaned in pain. The enemy had to be wearing bulletproof armor. It's hard to deliver a fatal blow with the meager penetration of buckshot and handgun bullets. Making a quick decision, Tsunaga cast aside the shotgun. He closed the distance in an instant, grabbing his opponent's gun with his bare hands before the man could fire and wrenching it upwards. The man's arms were trapped with the gun. He immediately abandoned the rifle, trying to draw the Chris Reeve knife in his sheath. But before he could, Tsunaga's hands seized him by the collar and sleeves of his outfit. An overwhelming storm of Herculean strength assaulted the man. His body rocked on its axis and he lost his center of balance. He couldn't stand, but by the time he thought that, his knees were already knocked out by a powerful sweep. Unable to support himself, the man fell backward into a concrete wall. The back of his head crashed into it with his full weight behind it. A dull sound rang out as the man's skull cracked. It was an Ouchigari from Judo. Or Ouchigari, rather. As the man's eyes rolled up, Tsunaga mercilessly slammed his elbow into him. The man's face looked like a pomegranate, and as he collapsed, Tsunaga dropped his heel on the neck, crushing its vertebrae. Next, Tsunaga drew the Gurkha knife hanging from his hip sheath and leapt to the side, rolling away. Automatic fire rained down on the spot he stood just a moment ago. The man he shot first had recovered. As Tsunaga rose, he threw the metal in his hands at the man. The bent, curved blade's thick ridge rushed at the man's face. The man swung his head, dodging it. His reflexes were excellent, but Tsunaga used that chance to close in on him. The man flipped his rifle around and swung the stock down. Tsunaga parried it with a Uchikori Uke and let off a front kick to his balls. The man quickly closed his crotch, absorbing the blow with his thighs. He stepped forward unshaken. As soon as he started to grapple, he swung his head like a pendulum and headbutted Tsunaga. Impact. Sparks flashed before Tsunaga's eyes and blood oozed from his cut eyelids. He shoved his opponent's shoulder, pushing him away and gaining distance. Then Tsunaga drove a left middle kick into him. His opponent rushed again, countering the blow. The sharp, heavy kick bore into the man's flank, dealing a hard blow to his liver. The man wavered in agony, but still managed to catch Tsunaga's leg against his side. He then pushed the unbalanced Tsunaga down with a Kokichi Taoshi from Judo. The man climbed on top of Tsunaga and held him down with his left hand, and his right hand had already drawn his knife. He showed shocking toughness and fighting spirit, but it's a far cry from the cool-headed malice lurking in Tsunaga. His opponent arced his torso back to attack, letting up on the pressure he was applying. Tsunaga's right flashed like a poisonous snake, aiming for that moment. Three fingers jabbed forward to crush the man's eyes from below. With his middle finger centered above the bridge of the man's nose, his index and ring finger gouged into his eyes. Blood squirted as the man screamed. As he bent back, Tsunaga forced him off from below and rose up. Then he locked both arms around the man's neck from behind. Holding that powerful clinch, he dragged him down and kneed him in the face. His nasal bone and eye socket caved in, and the man passed out and collapsed. Tsunaga picked his Gurkha knife up off the floor and moved to deliver the final blow. He was driven by an unconscious spinal reflexes owned by his instincts as a fighter, which is why Tsunaga couldn't react to the other murderous impulse. Bloody flesh burst from Tsunaga's side. A sharp bang rang out, and he stumbled back like he was hit by a huge hammer. He was shot. "You look like you have questions." Suddenly standing before him was the Caucasian man resembling a grim reaper. His lips were carved into a joyous smile. "Yeah, that's right. I waited, hidden in the darkness for the moment I could be sure to kill you. Even as you wounded and killed my allies before my eyes. The CZ-775s in Brian Kamau's hands let out a crisp sound as empty golden cartridges fell from them. "You bastard!" "I did the same thing you did. You and I are the same." This man had already seen through the commotion above. Tsunaga's strategy of using Allison's raid on Slumville. If he were to ask why, then the answer was as Brian already spoke, because it was something a man like himself would do. "So you saw through the decoy up top and knew we'd come from underground." Tsunaga was assaulted by intense burning pain. It's more than just his wound. The pain was a hot iron held to the nerves deep in his body. He coldly inspected his injury. The bullet hadn't gone through. It was stuck in his side near his intestines. Judging by the low blood loss, his veins were barely safe. It looked like his organs weren't injured either. Regardless, the wound wasn't light. The intense pain stabbing through his nerves was proof enough. The bullet eating into him was likely pressing on a nerve cluster. Just standing made him dizzy. Yeah. As plain as day, it was like reading the back of my hand. He spat out a clump of blood gathering in his throat. His stomach was bleeding, but judging by how strong the bitterness was, it would be a while before he died. In which case, Sunga gripped his Gurkha knife as he tasted the iron in his mouth. So long as his life held out, he would go after that man and close in on Shimon's jugular. Sorry about that. I was planning to put you down in one shot, but I ended up making you suffer. What a failure as a hunter. Though wounded, Sunuga gave off a beastly smell and abnormal hostility. Regardless, Brian spoke as he took that head on. Then he hit the magazine release buttons on both handguns in his possession. Two clips fell from the grips of the CZs and clattered to the floor at his feet. What are you doing? Figured I'd go after you like a warrior instead of a hunter from here on. Seems like I'd have more fun with you that way. Brian's thin lips twisted into a sadistic grin. He wasn't abandoning his advantage out of some spirit of chivalry. It was just a display of his perverted sadism and masochism. You'll regret that. Well, I've already got a handicap with a hole in your gut. Don't worry about it. Brian replied jokingly, slipping forward. The movements of his slender frame were as light as the wind, carrying no sense of weight. Sunuga stepped forward, unleashing a preemptive slash that took advantage of his weapon's length. Brian saw through its trajectory. At the same time, he leapt in and slashed with his right bayonet. Bayonet? Sunuga parried it, using his follow-through to spin back and swing his blade. The tricky flash cut through the air, rapidly serving to forestall Brian's follow-up with his left bayonet. Brian advanced again. Since his blades were shorter, the movement was necessary, but it wasn't his bayonets that struck out and caught Sunuga off guard. It was his long legs. His left snapped out like a whip in a low kick. Sunuga raised his knee and let it bounce off the outside, but without a moment's pause, Brian unleashed his right arm diagonally from above. The flash of his blade struck Sunuga's face as his focus was torn to his lower half. His prompt reaction let him catch it in time with his kukri, reflecting it slightly. Still, it had lightly cut the back of his hand. Brian pressed on, altering his attacks between left and right. It was a raging rush of successive blows connected by low kicks and backhands, a diagonal cross combination made possible by his training in Western kickboxing. Brian's attacks were like a ceaseless windmill, forcing Sunuga to defend and retreat. His back hit the wall of the tunnel. Brian's pupils widened in sadism as he cornered him. However, for Sunuga, that wall was as much a weapon as it was a dead end. Brian momentarily misjudged their distance as Sunuga leapt in with unexpected speed. His reflexive swing of his blade sliced only air. Sunuga used a powerful kick against the wall to jump forward. The flying knee kick meant to turn it all around, jammed into the Caucasian's jaw. The blow was delivered with perfect timing, but the gunshot wound robbed its force. Brian's right hand flashed. Intense pain, burning pain erupted again. The bayonet was digging deep into Sunuga's stomach. If his well-owned muscles hadn't served his armor, it would have skewered his organs. Ka-ka-ka, harakiri time, samurai! With a loud shout, Brian dug his blade straight to the side. The wound ripped open, spilling loads of blood on the tunnel ground. His strength faded with the loss of blood. His knees grew weak and he crumbled, unable to bear his own weight. He was at his limit. Sunuga didn't have the power to stand anymore. When he realized that, the tinge of madness drained from Brian's face. He was back to his usual lethargic junkie expression. Farewell, Sunuga. He announced his parting flatly with a shred of his earlier madness, like a child bidding farewell on his way home in the evening. Cold light shone off the bayonet in the darkness. The pomegranate glow flooded the area for a moment, sweeping over it and eliminating all. After exterminating all the enemies on her path ahead, Kira literally flew to Sunuga's side. Her rush passed supersonic speeds and Brian jumped back and dodged with his superior reflexes. A witch, huh? Boring. Carol brandished her large sword while covering Sunaga behind her as Brian muttered with a disinterested tone. How many humans has she cut down? Her blade was crimson from all the fresh blood soaking it. Shogo, I cleared the way. Go on ahead. Brian was a dangerous man, but he's also just a man. He was on a different tier below witches who could defeat whole squads in combat power. Sunaga made a call and left the rest to her. He rested himself on the tunnel wall for support, then crawled forward along the trail of blood Carol left behind. His blood-stained hand left brilliant streaks of red on the walls. He finished clearing the several hundred meters, nearly wringing out all his blood in the process. He made it to the service elevator directly below Slumville, then he collapsed into that metal box. His vision grew dark and narrow as he reached peak anemia. His shaky fingers reached for the up button, but then Sunaga lost consciousness. The sound of the service elevator starting up echoed in the distant darkness. With that sound at her back, Carol motionlessly stood her ground before Brian. You're like a loyal dog. What a rare witch you are. Brian was the one to break the silence. A faint light of interest began to glow in his gaze, which otherwise looked like a man staring at roadside sticks and stones. What's the meaning to your loyalty? Are you seeking love or gratitude from him in return? If you are, that's futile. He's long abandoned human emotion. Your devotion is barely worth his notice. He's capable of understanding it, but chooses to ignore it despite that. It's even crueler. Brian spoke with quick ease, as if he weren't discussing himself, but Carol's cat-like expressionless look hadn't changed in the slightest. After all, she derived her answer long ago. The words she spoke to Wilma at their parting in that mansion, those were the unexaggerated truth. The witch Carol was Sunaga Shogo's tool. And by making that fact the whole of her value, she was able to shake off all self-doubt she may ever have. Without any desire, she had nothing to lose either. And maybe twisted, but it probably wasn't a stretch to say that was Carol's strength after all. Or as well. Oh, so you've accepted him despite knowing that? Waves of emotion rippled in the desolate winter swamp of his eyes. They were ripples of interest in Carol as well as subconscious jealousy and rage. Brian had walked the corrupt wasteland of this world of worms, where all human love, thief's honor, and man's pride had been cast aside, and this was the first time he discovered another man who walked in that world, here in this base city. The man was none other than Sunaga Shogo, and that's why Brian became obsessed with him. He couldn't be apart from himself, the man he hated and loathed above all else. Sunaga was a reflection of that self. He wondered what state of mind he might achieve when he shattered that reflection named Sunaga. Brian wanted to know what would come after that. Would he finally be able to give up on himself, or would he just taste the despair of losing something irreplaceable? That perverted hope drew out unprecedented passion. Either way, you're in my way, Brian proclaimed with a deep, raspy voice that sounded like a bubble of decaying miasma rising and popping on the surface of a rotten swamp. My, our world needs only Brian McComhale and Sunaga Shogo. We don't need anybody else to understand us. They can't exist. Yes, such half-heartedness is despicable. We deserve to be base worms everyone spits at. This entire world is a pot where bugs like myself and Sunaga cannibalize each other to grow stronger. Before she knew it, she was drawn into Brian's delusional speech. But because of that, she was late to notice a silently progressing change. Suddenly, she felt something unpleasant grasping her ankle. She cast her gaze down at the wet, sticky sound and froze with shock. A maggot's! It was a tentacle like an octopus or squid's, yet also resembling human organs. The creepy color and sensation disturbed Carol on an instinctual level as a witch. Where did it but her fear and revulsion exploded, driving those logical thoughts away. She swung her blade down at her feet. The heavy weight of his metal severed the hard, rubbery mass of tissue. In that instant, something plopped down on her nape and onto her nape and shoulders. She couldn't avoid glancing up, even if she knew an abyss of further terror held its open maw there. This is... Above Carol's head, tentacles had grown thick like vines all over the ceiling, splitting into thin lengths like nerves. One of them was dividing its cells further, creating a rain of flesh as some byproduct. The piece of flesh on Carol's shoulder opened its tiny mouth, revealing human teeth the size of rice grains, and squeaked as it crawled its way towards her face. Carol's reasoning was dislodged and burned away in an instant. It was a source of fear and revulsion branded onto her soul. No witch could escape those emotions. Carol was now surrounded in a force of tentacles like some kind of nightmare. Where were they all coming from? However, Carol's eyes widened in further shock when she found out. All of them were extending from Brian's body, quietly protruding from the sleeves of his clothes. Like Shimon, he had fused maggot cells with his body. Brian was driving her into checkmate without even fighting. Sudden pain assailed an impossible area of her lower body. The tentacles she severed hadn't died. The remnant of maggot flesh gained independence, climbed up Carol's leg, and penetrated her filthy ass of all places. No! Carol was ravaged by discomfort and pain she never felt before. She never even allowed Sunaga entry into that spot. The maggot cells wriggled, burying themselves deeper into her organs through her anus. Carol suffered more than just shame. Intense languor and lethargy filled her entire body. Her power, the magic power that made her invincible as a witch, was evaporating. The secretions of the maggot cells seeped through Carol's membranes and neutralized her magic power. It resembled the way certain spiders injected paralyzing poison into their prey before capture. Carol crumpled to the ground from the sudden loss of strength. Tentacles wrapped around her wrists and tightened down. Carol's fingers were forced open by the pressure on her tendons. Her great sword, her brutal edge, fell from her grip. Carol's right hand scraped through the air for her fallen sword's hilt, but her arm was already entangled by the evil flesh. She'd lost the strength to oppose it. I won't kill you. Brian muttered in mockery as he stomped on Carol's brutal edge. Several tentacles wrapped around it, using their inhuman strength to break it. The metal blade instantly lost the power, transforming its mass, reverting to a puddle of blood. She'd lost her weapon, the symbol of a disastrous witch. That moment effectively sealed Carol's defeat. I'll toss you into a hall suitable to your foolishness. Anything else would be unfair to that man who used and discarded you. His nihilistic face, regained its expression. The impassioned madness he shown when facing Sunaga wasn't there. Only an obsessive hostility like a low fire broiling someone to death remained. It was an emotion derived from his sole desire to eliminate impurities from his world. Let me go! The evil fleshy whips clung to her limbs. A repulsive wet chill crawled over her skin, but Carol resisted as hard as she could, although her delicate build now only possessed the strength of the young girl she appeared to be. Her heart was filled with despair from her defeat, though her sole consolation was that she had shielded Sunaga and allowed his escape. It was a relief that she served her life's purpose as his tool. I will live and die for him. Ever since she met the man named Sunaga Shogo, that conviction had never once wavered. She held it close to her chest as she continued to resist Brian's violation. This is where we're at. I just wanted to make sure, guys, because it almost feels like where I was at, like, before I last, so I made it through about 60% of the game, and there's a whole scene we haven't seen yet, I don't think. Unless we have. Did we really get that far? I don't know. Maybe we did. Anyway, let's keep reading. I'm gonna read this fast, because I don't really like these scenes. Carol's whole body was bound. Several glistening flesh-toned tentacles were wrapped around her limbs and neck. The soft-wriggling inhuman organs were clearly growing from Brian McComhale's loins. They easily lifted Carol's body aloft with their force. My strength. If she could use her great strength as a witch, it would have been possible to rip through those blinds like they were nothing. But right now, the maggot secretions were invading Carol's body. Plus, her brutal edge, which was formed from most of her blood, her source of power, had been destroyed. That left Carol with nothing more than the strength of the delicate girl she appeared to be. Inept. Brian spat with little interest while glancing at Carol's continued resistance. Enjoy this opportunity while you can. Carol glared at Brian, issuing a challenge to him. She was hoping to agitate Brian into turning his focus onto her. In other words, she was buying time. That was the only means of supporting Sunaga left to her after his flight. These tentacles are easy to. The poor porcelain-white skin had plenty of resistance, with the powerful tendrils still dug in deep, bruising her. Even so, Carol tried to resist, all to show Brian he hadn't completely neutralized his prey yet. Whether she accomplished that goal or not, Brian turned from the darkness before him to Carol above him. Waiting for the moment Brian's eyes turned on her, Carol gave him a daring smile, to show him she didn't believe he'd kill her here. In fact, she truly believed that. If she were to die after proving useful to Sunaga, everything she wanted would have been achieved. Which was all the more reason she tried to bluff to draw out Brian's sadism. I won't lose! A cruel, cruel light resided in Brian's eyes as he looked up at Carol. In the end, Carol's devotion bore fruit. It did, however, mean she would be forced to endure more suffering. The tentacles stretching toward her dove towards her loins. They pressed up against a slit held by her thighs, brazenly forcing their way past her entrance and inside. They rubbed against the dry folds of her pussy, pressing their way in. The maggots were forcing their ugly protrusions into the genitals that never accepted anyone else, anyone aside from Sunaga. So deep, all at once? Carol felt dull pain from the forced entry, causing her eyes to shoot wide open as a scream escaped from her mouth. Brian watched her agony coldly, conducting her rape like it was a mass-produced affair. He thoroughly violated her womanly organs. The tendrils began thrusting wildly. There was no sexual technique to it. Like trying to use the nubs on their surface to stimulate her sensitive spots. They thrusted with mechanical, robotic motions and a destructive drilling that involved slamming their tip against her cervix. Even with the maggot secretions raising Carol's arousal, their intensity caused her to howl in agony. My womb! Tears welled at the corners of her eyes from the pain. The pain of her stomach getting pounded like a machine gun, repeatedly forcing the air from her lungs. Her mouth hung open as intermittent wails leaked out. Brian wasn't laying with a woman or even fucking them. From start to finish, it was a destructive pounding that just slammed his utmost spite into her. She underwent a baptism of unilateral violence. Damn. That's like an album title. Suddenly, her back arched backwards with realization. My magic powers, in addition to the physical harm his violence dealt to her body, the power within her was rapidly draining as well. No way. Carol quickly noticed the phenomenon. Brian was actively draining her power away from her. This is your... unique. She should have realized it the moment he freely manipulated his tentacles. This man was human, but he possessed the same powers as maggots. This was how he was able to hunt witches on his own, much like how he had tragically defeated Carol. No way. Carol's mind was tinged with anxiety and the fearsome pain of it crushing her womb. Brian had just made it clear that he had no intention of killing her now, meaning she was destined to face the same fate of captivity inflicted by the witch hunters. The moment that thought crossed her mind, Carol was assailed with an unfamiliar sense of misery. She intended to die here protecting Sunaga, but now she was destined to survive even longer, which meant she would have to live without Sunaga Shogo at her side. For the first time, she would lose sight of the guiding back she'd watched since the moment she was born into this world. Plus, he absolutely wouldn't come to her rescue. When Carol thought of that, she felt a deep, dark hole opening up within her heart. At the same time, she reaffirmed her true desire to live alongside Sunaga. This is fine. Still, she ignored her true feelings as she spoke. She told herself it was fine. That even without Sunaga as a guidepost, she could endure that absolute isolation. She tried to convince herself that it was another task as his tool. Her thoughts once again returned to her unshakable foundation. She couldn't let this man go after Sunaga. She had to draw his attention to her. Brian! She called out her enemy's name, glaring at him as she resisted with all the strength her delicate muscles could muster. However, the tentacles wouldn't budge, only digging further into her skin and cutting off circulation. Carol shook her head. I haven't lost... yet. Carol opened her mouth and bit down on the spongy tentacle. An awful raw taste filled her mouth. She did it to show her opponent she retained the power to resist and remain dangerous enough to strike him down if he lowered his guard. She worked as much power as she could into her jaw, biting into the fleshy tendril before her. Of course, she had already braced herself for the violation she'd receive afterwards. Brian remained expressionless. He slightly sneered as if he saw through Carol's intentions. At the same time, the pressure of the fleshy bonds wrapped around her suddenly increased. Carol's bones creaked loudly, and then... Her humerus cracked with a snap so loud it could be heard from a distance. Still, the tentacles continued to entwine around Carol's body. They put pressure on her torso as they wrapped around her like a serpent, causing more grating sounds. Her broken arm bones snapped further, increasing the burden on other parts. Even my ribs? Once the first crack started in her ribs, the second and third crack followed quickly. Then they all snapped at once. Carol let out a dying cry of agony as all her ribs shattered simultaneously. Her mouth spouted foam mixed with air as she suffered. She couldn't breathe right from the intense pain. All she could manage was convulsing like a bug with its limbs ripped off. He then mercilessly followed up on his assault. Inside my womb? Without giving her a moment to rest, the tentacle penetrating her cunt thrusted with more intensity. It finally forced her cervix open enough to pass and shoved itself into her womb. It's in my womb? Going wild! Brian's tentacles invaded her womb and immediately began incessantly slamming into her walls like a machine. It relentlessly battered her womb enough to temporarily distort its shape. It was enough for an imprint to appear on her skin from inside at the moment of impact. After the tentacle went wild in her womb, it withdrew back to her cervix, leaving her bewildered. Your suffering lasts for a moment, causing Carol to grow suspicious. At the same time, right as she was enjoying a moment of relief, the tip of the tentacle piercing her cunt sharpened its round head into a pointed lance and hardened again. The sound of ripping flesh echoed within Carol's body, and it thrust it out through her skin. The only reason it drew back was to deliver that atrocious blow. The sharp tip was covered in dark red blood, leaving bits of flesh and organs clinging to it. It punctured through the lining of Carol's womb and pierced through the organs and subcutaneous fat surrounding them. It even ruptured a hole through her abs and skin, poking its hardened head outside her body. Internal bleeding flooded her stomach with blood, immediately forcing her to cough up large amounts of it. Her eyes rolled back as she writhed, unable to handle the shock of her pain, receptors overloading. Oh, excuse me. Shit, I gotta read this again. Her mind was consumed in an intense white fire, flickering between darkness and flashes of light. Her body convulsed in an epileptic fit, shedding great spurts of fresh blood from her stomach wound with each tremor. This guy writes too damn much. Carol's mind was quickly fading. She was drawing closer to the verge of death, but in that moment a figure cut across her mind. Shogo. Carol forced her mind back to the surface. Not yet. Not yet, she told herself. She gritted her blood-coated teeth, holding back as she glared at Brian. She attempted to move the broken arm she couldn't get strength into. Her safe leg shuddered as she tried to kick one of the tentacles. Not yet, not yet. I can still move. I haven't lost. Huge spurts of blood flowed through her wound in her stomach, and fresh blood painted her lips as she wrung out a desperate cry. As if she was telling him she'd kill him from behind if he abandons her here and pursues Tsunaga. Brian's lips curled into a suppressed laugh at that. Carol couldn't help but feel shivers from the cold echo of his voice. Oh, you're safe, then we'll take that witch from... The reinforcements dispatched to the underground tunnels after the earlier request finally came running over. Nah, I'll bring her there like this myself. Brian turned down their offer with a death god sneer. Then he rushed a tentacle piercing Carol's stomach through her cunt and twisted it. The drill bore through her abdominal cavity, causing another huge eruption of blood. Scraps of flesh, bits of some unknown organ, splattered to the floor alongside the blood. Carol coughed up another huge glob of blood, body convulsing as if it was being electrocuted. Her mind rapidly fell into darkness. She tried to hang on to her fading consciousness with sheer willpower. Carol stubbornly refused to pass out, to die. Not yet. Not yet. However, her mind and body had already been pushed far beyond their limits, and they were forcibly shutting down like breakers being flipped off. Even still, Carol continued to refuse the mercy of that rest until she reached her ultimate limit. Heh. Brian let out a scornful scoff as he coldly observed her resistance. Carol's self-sacrifice to Tsunaga had coaxed intense irritation and indignation out of Brian. Her act was an unforgivable blasphemy toward his perception of the lonely world of maggots where only himself and Tsunaga Shogo lived. Pretty ideas and hypocrisies like sacrificing oneself for another didn't have any place in this world. Therefore, he couldn't stop from violating this witch with his own hands. It wouldn't be enough until he plunged her into hell. Brian McComale lifted the unconscious body of Carol and walked out of the utility tunnel, steeped with death and silence alongside his subordinates. Wow. The first dream Tsunade Shogo ever held was to live like the protagonist in a shonen manga. Their claims were always right, and they fought to defeat the bad guys one after another. Sometimes they would get hurt, but with all their allies around them, they won in the end and made everyone happy. He longed to become a man like that. It wasn't that unusual of an idea for a boy, though perhaps he could be called eccentric for actually taking actions toward that desire. However, the inconsistency between reality and shonen manga was made clear when he delivered justice. The real world is built on a society with laws. Laws which don't approve of violence. He learned that the justice carried out by his manga's protagonist was all lumped together under the word violence in the real world. It was improper to hit others, even if they were bad guys. The moment young Tsunade made bad guys cry by giving them a nosebleed with his fists, they became the victims and he became the bad guy. He mulled over how unreasonable that was as he groaned from pain in his butt that night. From the pain in his butt that night, swollen from his parents' spanking. Why couldn't he become a protagonist? It really drove home how hard it was to determine the bad guy in the real world. The world only had crimes designated by laws, and evil only existed as a subjective concept in people's minds. The standards for determining evil fluctuated with circumstances and position, so it was impossible to clear it up logically. Protagonists and bad guys didn't exist in the real world. This realization was the first step young Tsunade took toward becoming an adult. His admiration for such fiction was quickly broken and forgotten at a young age. However, there was a part that never left him. There was the itchy heat that lingered in his hand and the feeling of hitting another, along with the truth that one blow of his fist had decisively resolved his friend's problem with no adult could. In short, Tsunade had swung his fist to save a friend being bullied by larger children. In their parents' world, the issue seemed resolved on the surface with discussion, but the problem continued in their world of children. Learning that, Tsunade fumed with righteous indignation for his friend. After that incident, the problem was resolved all too easily by the unaccepted violence he wielded. It was like magic. Its clarity captured Tsunade's heart. In a world where the difference between good and evil was uncertain, its absolute nature was a fundamental force worth believing in. At the same time, the sanctions he received from adult society taught Tsunade that violence needed to be restrained. His secret urge to wield that magic within him as he pleased without being punished as a crime under law grew with every passing day. By coincidence, he discovered a means for venting that urge from his TV screen. It was his first time watching a live broadcast of a professional martial arts match. The big half-naked men with own bodies pelted each other with unrestrained punches and kicks. Their faces swelled as they were battered, shedding blood. The sight was shocking enough for Tsunade, but what was more surprising was the reaction of his sister and father as they watched it beside him. They were going crazy for the exchange of bloody violence, even offering their cheers. It was a huge contradiction to Tsunade. What he saw being performed on the screen was nothing other than an exchange of violence. Despite that, the elders who chastised his violence were now encouraging it. Like a child, he turned his frank question on them. Their answer wasn't like a vague Zen dialogue saying that it was violence, even though it was. Apparently, violence exercised within certain constraints fell under a different category called sports. That was accepted by society. There, Tsunade found an outlet for the violent urges within him, a way to slake his thirst for that absolute in this world of chaos. In short, it led to an idolization of martial arts. As an elementary schooler, he threw himself into karate and judo training. His abnormal desire made it possible for him to put in several times more effort and diligently hone his talent. When Tsunade was in high school, he met his destiny. It happened when he visited the judo department of the police headquarters for outside training. The judo of those stalwart officers was on an overwhelming level of physical strength and bore a roughness that went beyond competitive sports. Tsunade had already fought with college judo practitioners and won top medals in national competitions before he participated. While the officer struck his chin after faking a grab for his collar, slammed elbows and knees into his stomach while pinning him, their savage style of judo felt more like blatant violence than martial arts. While the robust college students cried under their baptism, Tsunade, the youngest among them, lunged in with excitement. Of course, his cheeky refusal to break after defeat led to a thorough thrashing. The current leader of Society Bureau, Igo Nobutake, watched him the whole time. Igo was drawn to Tsunade's fighting instincts, which surpassed the normal high schoolers. At the same time, he sensed a danger there, too. After that, Igo built a personal friendship with Tsunade. He would visit to train him, and each day they would go to eat. Over the course of those exchanges, Igo passionately explained the life of an officer. Hey, Shogo, why don't you skip college and join our force? You want me as an officer? Leaving a guy like you on the Leaving a guy like you on the loose as a civvy is like leaving an unexpected bomb lying around, and I can't rest easy. It's trouble for us if dangerous people stay out of our sight. Comes with a job, you could say. That's mean, Igo-san. You're treating me like a dangerous suspect. Besides, if you grow strong, then that's... even more reason to join us. We'll train you up even more than you are now. Well, not that I plan on you losing for another 10 years. That's true. It's worth considering if you're going to treat me for another 10 years. Once you earn your first paycheck, it's your turn to treat me. While part of his reasoning was wanting Tsunaga's sense of justice and talent as a fighter, the other was to chain him within the law and cage him with the power of the state. His intuition had already determined that Tsunaga Shoga was too dangerous a man to leave loose in society with his latent capacity for violence. He just had to make him an officer and make sure it was never directed at non-criminals. Part of it was also a parental affection and the belief that he could protect Tsunaga as an officer if he did happen to cause someone's death with his violence. Igo had known men like Tsunaga well. And so, Tsunaga entered the police academy as Igo hoped, and after graduation he became a riot officer and under the Tokyo Metropolitan Police Department Security Bureau. In less than a few years, he distinguished himself and passed a strict test to join the SAT squad under Igo's command. He managed to clear the difficult hurdles toward becoming an elite officer out of his desire to be with the man he admired. His SAT training was brutal. Since he would be authorized to shoot suspects to death, they thoroughly drilled the weight of that trigger and marksmanship into his muscles and bones. This was especially true during their raid exercises conducted in the Kill House, a model building similar to a film set. The CQB training they underwent their focus on thoroughly driving home that discernment between two types of motorized target boards. One set of boards would be the terrorists or criminals, the other would be hostages or civilians. This world had two categories, people meant to be killed, or other people meant to be protected. The training carved the ability to make that mental distinction deep into Tsunaga's subconscious so he could make it in extreme situations. So long as he retained that backbone, he could remain an officer securing justice, just like the protagonist he once admired in his shonen manga as a kid. The days spent training were hard, but Tsunaga had friends. No, they were more. Close enough to call themselves one and the same race of creatures. They were like him. People deviated from the norm somehow. They were all men secretly bearing vast violence in their bodies and souls. Men who might have been doing who knows what if they hadn't become cops. Tsunaga learned the joy of sharing his hardships and pleasures with compatriots whose souls were on the same wavelength. He thought this was the center of his world. Even if the world was chaos where justice and evil didn't exist, so long as he bore the armor of being an officer, he wouldn't lose what defined himself. The magic permitted under the law would grant him that certainty. Then, several years later, the fateful day arrived.